The Speaker of the Nova Scotia House of Assembly grants permission to record the televised proceedings of the legislature for use in schools and for other purposes, such as private study, research, review, or newspaper summary. Television and radio broadcasters may make use of recorded excerpts of the televised proceedings in their news or public affairs programs for the purpose of fair and accurate reports of proceedings. Program material may not be used for political party advertising, election campaigns, or any other politically partisan activity. Program material may not be edited for use in promotional material by any political party or other organization, and may not be used in any edited form that could mislead or misinform an audience or viewer, or which does not present a balanced portrayal of the proceedings in the House. Video program material may only be used with its original audio components, and no other audio material may be added to video material used. Any other commercial use or rebroadcast of these proceedings requires the express written approval of the Speaker.
Good morning, everyone. I would like to welcome you to this public accounts meeting. I call this meeting to order. Today we have with us the Department of Finance and the Department of Health and Wellness. We will start with introductions, beginning with Mr. McGuire.
Good morning, everyone. Brendan McGuire, Halifax Atlantic.
Good morning. MLA Suzanne Lonis-Croft, Lunenburg.
Morning. Chuck Porter, Hans West.
Joachim Stroink, Halifax Chabucto.
Ian Rankin, Timberley Prospect.
Good morning. Welcome. My name is Tim Houston. I'm the MLA for Pictou East.
Good morning. Dave Wilson, MLA for Sackville-Cobequid.
My name is Alan McMaster, MLA for Inverness, and your chair. We have also with us the Auditor General's Office. We'll have Mr. Spicer begin with his introduction.
Terry Spicer, Deputy Auditor General.
And Tammy Squires.
Actually, your mic is on.
And Tammy Squires.
Thank you, Ms. Squires. I'll start with introductions of our guests, beginning with Ms. Kumaranayake.
Lalani Kumaranayake, Executive Director of Fiscal Planning, Economics and Budgetary Planning in the Department of Finance and Treasury Board.
Robert Bourgeois, Director of Financial Accounting in Finance and Treasury Board.
Byron Rafuse, Deputy Minister of Finance, Department of Finance and Treasury Board.
Good morning, Denise Perrett, Deputy Minister, Health and Wellness.
Good morning, David Bartol, Senior Executive Director, Corporate Services and Asset Management, Department of Health and Wellness.
Good morning, Dr. Robert Strang, Chief Medical Officer of Health in the Department of Health and Wellness.
Good morning, Tim Guest, Vice President, Integrated Health Services and Chief Nursing Officer for the Nova Scotia Health Authority.
And Christine Gibbons, Executive Director of Corporate Process and Quality with Health and Wellness.
Thank you, everyone. A reminder to ensure your phones are on silent. Today's topic is healthcare funding and the Auditor General's follow-up on Auditor General recommendations from 2013 and 2014 Auditor General reports. We will allow some time for opening comments from both Finance and Health and Wellness. Perhaps we'll begin with Health and Wellness and Ms. Pratt.
Thank you. As noted, the subject is healthcare funding with a focus on federal transfers and the Auditor General report from 2013-2014, those recommendations. There's two parts to federal funding. There's the Canada Health Transfer, which is focused on having provinces and territories adhere to the principles of the Canada Health Act. And it tends to be, it's a per capita funding that doesn't have strings tied to it except for those principles under the Act. And new funding that has been announced by the federal government is accord funding, which is focused on what the feds would say is health system transformation. And so they put in additional money, specifically, as they state, to improve health outcomes for Canadians as one of their goals and to address gaps in the healthcare system. And their focus has been in the discussions that we've had and in their and their discussions in the media on home care. So they are reinforcing that shift we see across the country from acute to community, and on mental health funding with a special emphasis on providing filling gaps in services for those under 25 years of age. So just as provinces and territories have recognized the need for a shift in health in the way healthcare systems are structured and how we provide services, the federal government has also expressed its commitment to effect change. And there's a research binder that's put together for members of this committee. It was particularly well done, I thought, for this session. And one of the items in it is David Naylor's report on innovation in healthcare. And it's an important report. It's one that shouldn't be on a shelf. It should be in front of everyone. Because Dr. Naylor, in a very straightforward manner, sets out what some of the issues are in our healthcare system and the opportunities and challenges before us. It's a very instructional document and a good background for the discussion that I'm anticipating here this morning. He notes, and we've discussed this before, that access to primary care in this country has been an ongoing concern for over two decades. And he observes, his words, are that Medicare in Canada is badly aging. And so we've had this discussion, and I have to say that in the Nova Scotia context, because all provinces and territories are faced with these challenges and opportunities, the one thing that stands out for me is that we're seeing a tremendous response from outside of government circles, from front care health workers. Doctors Nova Scotia issued a report that went public today. I've met with pharmacists, paramedics we've discussed in this chamber. There are a number of people that step up to the challenge. And as I learn more about the story in this province, it's very much like the 90s. In the 90s, we had significant fiscal challenges in health, and we saw dramatic responses. The closure of hospital beds, we saw many of the same issues that we're dealing with today with ED departments that were closing and the like. And what came out of that is a tremendous innovation, particularly in community paramedicine, which, as we've discussed, is leads the world in many respects. So we had the pleasure of hosting the Federal Health Minister in late January. She toured the EHS Community Communication Centre, very interested to hear about the response of the paramedic community to providing services to seniors in the community and how that could be scaled and spread in Nova Scotia and across the country. She received a presentation from pharmacists on the Bloom program, which is a program that provides in-depth medication management to those suffering from mental illness. And also importantly, the pharmacists provide important navigational services for patients and link with other healthcare providers in a collaborative fashion. And there's about 221 patients enrolled in that program. And she learned a bit about our Strongest Families Institute and how we have online services through phone and internet, providing mental health services to children, youth, and families. And so her response to that was that she was impressed, and that was in line with what the federal government is thinking it wants to support as we move forward. In regard to the recommendations from the Office of the Auditor General, I think we can report that good progress is being made by the Department of Health and Wellness and by the Nova Scotia Health Authority. In particular, we're pleased with the progress in public health. Recently, there have been announcements that we've adopted the Panorama IT solution So that is going to provide us with an immunization and vaccine inventory, we predict, by fall of 2017. And it increases our ability to track and report on notifiable diseases and increase our surveillance capacity. And this is really important because the more we know about population health needs, the more we can respond on a community level and organize collaborative care, primary care, to meet the needs of specific communities. We know that there's been also a lot of work done in meeting the recommendations on alternative funding payments to physicians. Where there is still work to be done is on wait times. And I note that there's been both a significant investment on this front. We had an additional $4.2 million in 2014-15, another $2 million in 2015-16, and $8.1 million in 16-17. And what we've seen in the most recent report is that Nova Scotia, and I think it was the only province, showed significant improvement on all fronts. That doesn't mean that it's reached the levels that it needs to reach, but the investments seem to be moving us in the right direction. There's always more work to do, and I'm very appreciative that Tim Guest from the Health Authority is here to address questions you may have on that front. So I'll close there and look forward to your questions. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Perrette. Mr. Rafus, would you like to offer some comments?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Good morning to the committee. I'd like to make some brief opening remarks on healthcare funding and the follow-up to the Auditor General's 2013 and 14 recommendations. Nova Scotia is one of nine provinces and three territories that have agreed in principle to a new healthcare funding. As with other federal funding, the formalization of this will be done through federal legislation. Originally, we had called this an agreement, but now that it's being implemented, it will now be implemented through legislation because more provinces are on board. The Canada Health Transfer is an unconditional transfer designed to assist provinces and territories with health care funding, as the Deputy of Health has indicated. To receive the transfer, the province must agree to the five principles of the Canada Health Act: universality, accessibility, portability, comprehensiveness, and public administration. Starting in 2014 and 15, the Canada Health Transfer was modified to distribute a national pool of cash on an equal per capita basis, based on the jurisdiction's share of the national population. At that time, the CHT was extended in federal legislation for 10 years, and the end year being 2023-2024. Beginning in 2017-18, the escalator within the CHT became the three-year average growth of the national nominal GDP, with a floor of 3%. The floor will be in effect for the 2017-18 fiscal year. For 2017-18, the national pool of cash is $37.1 billion. Nova Scotia is estimated to receive $967.2 million based on having 2.6% of the national population. In addition to the Canada Health Transfer, the federal government has offered the provinces and territories $11 billion per capita of targeted funding for home care, and that's $5 billion across the next 10 years. For mental health, that's $5 billion across the next 10 years. And for home and community health care infrastructure, and that's an additional $1 billion over the next 4 years. The province is currently in the process of finalizing the details regarding the reporting under this targeted funding. Revenue for the targeted funding initiatives will be commenced in 2017 and 18. Further details of this will be provided in the province's budget of 2018, which will be tabled on April the 27th. Nova Scotia receives about one-third of its overall revenue in transfers from the federal government. The Canada Health Transfer is the second largest of these transfers. In 16-17, that amounted to $944 million. I should note that health care spending is government's biggest expense and is at currently $4.3 billion. The rising cost of health care is a challenge for every jurisdiction in Canada at the present time. We have made strong efforts in Nova Scotia to slow the budgetary growth in this sector using innovation and technology to deliver health care, joint purchasing, shared services, and reducing the administrative costs within the province. I believe my colleague at the Department of Health would agree that the partnership we have with the federal government is very important for the health and wellness and the services we provide to the citizens of Nova Scotia. In relation to the Auditor General's reports of 2013 and 2014, I'm pleased to report that the Department of Finance and Treasury Board has completed 18 of the 25 recommendations. Furthermore, we have plans to complete five more of the remaining seven this year. Of the remaining two, we have partially completed those requirements and continue to work on full implementation. To highlight the work the Department of Finance has completed, we have updated procedures and process to support the government's financial statements and communications with stakeholders. These processes include updating processes and procedures supporting major line items in our consolidated financial statements, within our revenue estimate process, and the thresholds related to tax changes. We also ensured amounts in the general revenue fund and the consolidated financial statements are supported and reported in accordance with the public sector accounting standards. And we have improved communications between ourselves and government agencies to ensure that timely completion of responses or issues and deficiencies that are identified in their statements and by their auditors are dealt with in a timely manner. I thank you for the time at the opportunity for the opening remarks, and I look forward to the committee's questions.
Thank you, Mr. Rafuse. We'll begin with Mr. Houston of the PC Caucus for 20 minutes.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you for the opening comments. Deputy Rafuse, can we get a copy of your opening comments? There's a lot of numbers in there, which I appreciate. If we could get a copy of that, that'd be great.
Could I wait till I get you a clean copy? I have a lot of notes sitting up, but no problem.
I wouldn't mind your notes.
Again.
I just was trying to capture, the Premier announced a deal with the federal government 2 days before Christmas. It was a deal, an agreement. I think you referred to it, we're not calling it an agreement anymore because it's going to end up in legislation. It's probably still, they agreed to something. There's a lot of moving parts probably to what was agreed. Most of those moving parts are unclear to me. I've watched some of the minister's press clippings, and it seems like maybe they might be unclear to him as well. But I'm wondering how unclear they actually are. So do you have anything you can provide to this committee that says this is what we agreed to 2 days before Christmas in terms of the funding that will come each year and what the stipulations might be around that? Could you table something for this committee that would show what the agreement was?
Mr. Rafuse?
When I give you copies of my opening remarks, that actually does outline of it. And I said, we originally called this an agreement because at the time, as you realize, there was bilateral conversations going on because the discussions at the national table were not successful. At that time, in December, there were three provinces that had agreed additional funding for health care. And at that time, since there was only three provinces, our discussions with the federal government was, well, we need to have this wrapped up in some type of an agreement. And as we worked through that, it was quite clear to us that the federal government were actually having conversations with other jurisdictions because that kind of conversation kind of slowed down for them. So we stopped talking about an agreement. And it wasn't until we actually got confirmation when the federal government tabled its budget that it did enable the transfers of this additional money, which is on outside of the CHST, to be enabled the federal government to do it, which is, in fact, the more typical way in which government federal transfers do occur to provinces. There usually isn't an agreement per se. There's an understanding, and then it's embedded in legislation. So right. Those things that I did talk about earlier, that there are, because the principles of the CHST remain, but there are targeted funding for home care, mental health, and infrastructure in those areas.
So I want to talk about that. So first off, just so I understand, who negotiates the agreement? Was it the Department of Finance or Department of Health, or who actually represents Nova Scotia in those negotiations?
At the federal, provincial, territorial finance meetings in December, the ministers of health were asked to join that meeting, and likewise at the ministers of health FTME meeting, and I believe it was in October, the ministers of finance joined that meeting. So it's been a joint effort of both departments, along with the Premier's office and all jurisdictions and the federal government.
So, in terms of what came out of the deal is, the deal was signed very quickly. I mean, it's obviously, and who knows, maybe we can find out why that was, why we jumped. I do have some questions about how that deal improves healthcare in Nova Scotia, because that's not certainly not clear to me at all. But going into those discussions, and certainly a lot of media reports have suggested that the transfer rate that was agreed to is not what's needed to maintain the level of services in this province. So in other words, there was a lot of discussion. I've seen the number 5.2, which is a very precise number, that we would have needed federal transfers to escalate at 5.2% a year to maintain the level of services that we have. That's not the deal that was reached. So I'm wondering, are you familiar with that 5.2 number?
Yes.
Is there any validity to that number, that's a number that would have made the finances of this province around healthcare work more efficiently and effectively? Is there any validity to that number? Is it a number that came from your department, or?
Leading up to this conversation, there was a lot of work done at the official level to talk about what the healthcare spending growth has been across the country. There was this work was done by all provinces and territories. It looked at the historical trend pattern of healthcare spending and also the federal government's participation rate in provincial healthcare spending. At one time, that rate was at approximately the 50% level with the federal government. That has dropped down to levels, depending on what province you're in, and if, you know, you're in the, let's say, the 20 to the low 20% rate. Those percentages came out of thinking out of those groups where, if you look at perhaps historical spending patterns, that was where there was a rate of around 6% was developed. The 5.2, I believe, was a rate which would bring the federal government's participation up to the 25% level, as that being the appropriate target for federal participation and provincial health care expenditures. The difficulty, or it's not the difficulty.
Is that relevant to Nova Scotia? 5.2 would have brought us up to 25%?
Not sure. That was a national average. I'd have to get the precise amount for Nova
Scotia.
Okay,
do we have? Yeah, it'd be interesting to have the precise number. If 25% is kind of what people accept is what the Fed should be paying, are we at 25%?
No, we're not at. And Craig, that is a guiding point. There's no requirement for the federal government to be at 25. In fact, there was no requirement for the federal government to change anything. They had an agreement on health care funding that reaches out and legislation in place that goes to 2024-25. So there was no obligation to the federal government to do anything. This was an ask from the provinces. They were looking for amounts because the Canada Health Act had previously had escalator clauses around 6%. That was changed back, as I indicated.
It was a huge issue in an entire federal election. So I don't want to debate what the federal government is obligated to do or shouldn't do, but they certainly made some promises to get themselves elected and then now changed. So I'm more interested in how the impact of that change on Nova Scotians. So they're not at, they're, it would have taken, I guess what I'm hearing is 5.2 was a kind of a number that's relevant nationally. And the relevance of the number is that it would bring the federal contribution to the cost of health care in provinces up to 25%. Mm-hmm. We're going to get the number for Nova Scotia, but it sounds like the provinces, I guess, universally accepted that 25% is what we should strive for as the federal contribution. Would that be fair to say that was the provinces, including Nova Scotia's position, that the Fed should be paying about 25%? Would it be fair to say that should be the Nova Scotia position? You should be paying 25%?
That was the position that was presented at the table as a negotiating
position. Okay, so that was our starting point. And our ending point was quite a bit lower, even though we were amongst the first people to stand up on the chair and say, isn't this wonderful, we got a deal. But we didn't get a deal that's helpful to the province, is what I'm wondering. So this year, the federal transfers under the Canadian health transfers, I think you said $967 million. And then an additional amount under the targeted funding. What's the additional amount for this year under the targeted funding?
The additional amounts of the targeted funding will be included in our budget, which will be tabled in, on April the 27th.
Okay, so you're not able to say what that amount is?
No, I really, its convention would be I would not release an amount that's not.
Okay, but the 967, that's you can say that because that's some old formula, is it? Or?
That's not only is that, that's actually on the federal government's website. They give us that information on CHT funding in December, where they actually project what it is based on the formula for the upcoming year, and they revise the amount for the current year we're in based on an updated figure of our population.
Okay, and that presumably they'll put the targeted funding number online too when they're ready, I guess?
I think they would be, but that would be up to the federal government.
Okay. The timing of the is there anything you could point your finger to that says, well, that was so compelling what they offered 2 days before Christmas that we just had to sign it right at that moment? Well, is there anything you can kind of succinctly say is this is the reason we jumped at this so quick? Because a lot of people would say that the fact that our maritime provinces, the Atlantic provinces, jumped pretty quick, that obviously gave some momentum to the federal government that I personally would say hurt all Canadians in their negotiations with this. But that's my personal opinion. But what can you point to that says we had to sign this right then and there? I don't know, other than...
I think that'd be a question best asked to the ministers and the premiers who make the decision on whether or not to accept that deal. I can tell you that at the federal provincial meetings in December, when there was an agreement on the funding, the federal government actually pulled all funding off the table, and there was nothing on the table at that point for targeted funding. So the reason to accept that deal is one in which you should really speak to those individuals. I would just advise them about what the implications would be on a fiscal perspective.
Okay. Were you surprised did you hear it in the news the same time I did that a deal had been reached?
I was part of the conversation.
Okay. So were you, how would you characterize your feeling when you heard that the minister said, I signed it?
I advised them on the financial implications of what the deal was and what the dollars would mean based on our understanding of the agreement.
Okay. The province signed the deal. Odd timing, just before Christmas, obviously. Also odd timing because we signed it when we were probably recruiting a new deputy minister of health. I'd like to ask the deputy minister, were you aware of these as you started the job on a certain day? You probably were offered the job sometime before that. Was this deal signed after you were offered the job? If you can remember the timeline.
Ms. Parrott?
So I was officially offered the job on November, at the very end of November. So it was signed after I was offered the job.
Okay.
But I had not started. I didn't commence until January 16th.
Okay. Do you recall, were you consulted or kept informed during the month of December that this was happening and they're probably going to sign a new deal? Because I know when you get offered a job, you're not really on the payroll, but you kind of start assimilating yourself into the culture and getting up to speed. Were you consulted at all on what made you sign?
No, I was working in my former job until the end of the first week in January, so my loyalties were there, and I removed myself from all federal provincial matters.
Okay. Deputy Rayfuse, in your opening remarks, you referred to the funding is unconditional at one point, but you also referred to the five principles that must be respected. So it's my understanding that if one of those principles is not respected in some way, it can jeopardize all of the funding. There is some risk around the funding, right? So you have to respect the principles, otherwise the funding is at risk. Is that fair?
Mr. Rayfuse?
That would be my understanding, but those principles were pretty broad, yes.
Yeah, yeah, okay. So, but I'm just wondering about the types of things that could put the funding at risk. The Nova Scotia Health Authority is going through an accreditation process right now. Maybe the Deputy Minister of Health can tell us the accreditation for the health authority is, I read that it was the spring of 2017. Has the accreditation process started?
Ms. Parrott, sorry.
Yes, sorry. Can I check with Mr. Guest on the specifics?
Mr. Guest.
We have started our preparation for the accreditation process, and our visit is in October of 2017.
Okay. So there's reports in the media every day now, and even the deputy of minister referred to some of the reports that have come out from doctors, from the NSGEU. I'm thinking of issues like the code census and issues around the delivery of healthcare that people are rightly so concerned about right now. Is that the type of thing that can impact the accreditation process?
Mr. Guest?
Not directly. How we plan for and respond to those issues would be more relevant in that process.
Okay. I do want to talk about the delivery of certain services in certain areas of the province and not in others. And I'm thinking about that in the context of the universality of the delivery of healthcare. So we are supposed to have universal access to healthcare services to every citizen in every province in this country. That's one of the principles. But when I look at some of the services that are delivered, particularly in rural areas, I'm going to talk about palliative care. There's Richmond was an example. Somebody said to me this week that in Richmond County, you can't get access to palliative care services after 4 p.m. each day. And then when I dug in, somebody said, well, actually, the health department's palliative care framework explicitly states that people cannot be expected to provide this type of care everywhere in the province. I don't know how familiar you are with palliative care, the palliative care framework, Deputy, but I'm wondering about, are these the types of things we should be concerned about in terms of the transfer money?
Ms. Parrott?
So I wouldn't link it directly to the transfer money. So I wouldn't make it a direct link. I can comment that one of the things that the federal government has promoted very strongly is that it wants the cord funding. It sees it as an incentive to improve the provision of palliative care in the province. It feels quite strongly about that, I think, in the context of medical assistance in dying as well, that it sees a need to have a provision of full services there. And it has seen that as a gap across the country. So it is trying to provide incentives and direction on addressing those gaps.
Okay, so you don't have any concerns about the universality of healthcare delivery in this province. Is there any areas where you're concerned about that maybe we're not meeting that criteria?
So I didn't say I didn't have concerns. When we talk about universality, certainly if we talk about it in terms of transfers, that only applies to funding for hospital and physician care. So the terms of the Canada Health Act on universality is just that Canadians get hospital care and physician care in the insured services context paid for by public funds. That's what universality means. So I was answering in that context, and I believe we do that in Nova Scotia. The federal government has no concerns with our payment for those services here.
Okay. So we have a number of areas in this province right now where people don't have a doctor. We have a number of areas in this province where people might call around to a neighboring community, to a physician's office, and they're asked, where do you live? And they're often told, you don't live in our geographic area. We can't take you on as a patient. That's an issue for me. That's an issue around access to primary health care, and I'm hearing about patients being dismissed. We have that in our community, being dismissed from a collaborative care clinic. So is that where are we at in healthcare in this province when you call up to try and get a doctor's appointment and they ask you where you live and then say, no, I can't help you because you live in that area and not this area? Where are we at in healthcare in this province when you call a doctor's office and the first person that answers the phone asks you, well, why is it that you want to see the doctor? Because, well, no, you can't see the doctor for that. Because that's what's happening. Because this takes so long to get patients. They need gatekeepers to figure out. That doesn't seem like universal access to healthcare. Does it seem like it to you?
So I agree that that's where Nova Scotia, other provinces are focused on how to improve that access. And as we've discussed, part of the improvement to access is to increase the number of providers that are able to support each other and to back each other up. Because if we're just going to focus on access through a physician, we have quite a narrow gate there. If we look at all our 40,000 healthcare providers and use them to their full scopes in collaborative teams, we increase the access point. So as we've discussed, that's the focus of what we are, the part of the shift, part of the change we're trying to affect in this province. Your question has a number of angles on it, and I would agree with you. Some of the responses that you just indicated that people receive would concern me. But as we are restructuring the system, and I was very pleased to see Doctors Nova Scotia with its report, because I think that opens up an important discussion. But partly we're talking about to what degree do physicians have autonomy as to where they locate, who they see, when they work, and to what extent, and we feel increasing public pressure, does the province come in and try to manage that and plan for that? So there's a shift there.
Yeah, and the shift is fine, and the vision's fine, and all those things, a doctor for every Nova Scotian, well, maybe not this year, maybe in 3 years and stuff, but I guess that's all fine. I don't have a lot of faith in the execution on that. But I just ask a simple question. If where we're at now in the last 2 years and 3 years and 4 years, there hasn't been universal access to health care in this province, has there?
In terms of what the federal government considers universal access, there is.
Order. Time has expired. We'll move to the NDP. Mr. Wilson for 20 minutes.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you for being here. And actually, I'll keep on the theme that my colleague has just brought up, and that's around physicians and their ability to provide care to Nova Scotians. Are you aware of the Supreme Court ruling in BC when the British Columbia government tried to, I would say, dictate to physicians in that province where they could practice? And the Supreme Court ruling had indicated that the province is limited on doing that, and they couldn't do that. Are you familiar with that ruling, and are you concerned with the approach that the current government and the health authority has taken could potentially put us at risk of physicians in this province taking the same path that physicians in British Columbia took to try to tell the government of the day you can't restrict access to primary care, access to family doctors, because of where you live in the province?
So I'm not intimately familiar with the BC case. I think that there have been a number of initiatives by different provinces looking at how to plan for services, to improve access for services. And as I said, because traditionally we have private providers in primary care on the physician community who have a great deal of autonomy in where they locate and how they go. So it needs to be a collaborative effort to have that planning process. I think that that some of the restrictions, you'll look, I mean, the other province that actually does it more proactively and within the bounds of the Constitution is Quebec. So there are ways of planning the system to focus on patients, to focus on communities and what they need, because that's at the heart of everything. And I think we have general agreement with the professions and the health authority and the department that that's where we start, and then we'll have those discussions and sort things out.
So you've mentioned that there are restrictions. Would you agree that the current government, the system itself, the health authority, are placing restrictions on physicians on where they can practice and who they can see in the province?
So there are no restrictions on a physician being licensed in the province.
Okay, so that's the interesting part of it, because you know I understand Dr. Harrigan indicated to physicians that you are able to practice anywhere in the province, but the kicker to it is that approval to order tests will be, that's what's restricted. So it's great that you can have a license to practice anywhere in the province. Just hope that your patients that you're seeing don't need tests to be ordered. So is that correct? That yes, they can practice anywhere, but they won't be given access to order tests at the local hospital or clinic in the area that would do the testing needed to try to determine what is actually wrong with a patient if they're seen at a physician's office?
So my understanding is that, and as a relatively new initiative, the health authority is looking at credentialing as one tool in negotiations with physicians as to how we service individuals and communities. So the starting point is, what are the needs of communities, where are our primary care assets, and how do we plan to serve those communities and individuals better? And that sometimes is a negotiation and possibly a bit of a tension between autonomy and the service to the community. Where I think we come together, where I think there is, where you can bring the discussion around to agreement, is that increasingly we know we need to focus on health needs of communities, and we need to talk about these issues with the patient at the center. And then we'll talk about how we serve the patient and accommodate provider interests. So one of the things we're doing in response to balancing physician autonomy and gaps in primary care service is building these teams. So we're putting in linkages. And by saying linkages, I don't want to underestimate the value of these services. We have nurse practitioners, and we've talked about it in this forum, and the Naylor report in your page 7, I believe, in your package, says since the 70s, we know that nurse practitioners can do 70% of what a general practitioner can do effectively without affecting negatively health outcomes or expectations. So to fill the gaps in the first order of business isn't to restrict where physicians are going. It's to put in new resources such as nurse practitioners, family practice nurses, and then we'll start to connect things. And we'll
why would we jump ahead of having that in place by restricting ability for physicians to open up a practice? And I know it's been very frustrating, and it kind of is counter to what the Premier's commitment to Nova Scotians has been since he tried to seek office in, 4 years ago, and that's a doctor for every Nova Scotian. So we talk about a collaborative approach, which I agree with, we understand, but ultimately Nova Scotians need access to family doctors. Is this an exercise to get around the legal requirement of a province to make sure that they don't infringe on the charter, the rights of physicians? It sounds like. And I was very frustrated when Dr. Harrigan was here when I said that there are restrictions in place, and she was indicating there wasn't. And we know the example of the community of Weymouth, for example. So is this just an exercise to make sure that you're not, the government won't find itself in court in a few years or in a few months or whenever that happens? I know it's a long process, so most likely a few years. Is that what's behind some of the changes and the language of not saying we're not giving a license to a physician to practice in the province, but not offering privileges really handcuffs their ability to provide primary care? I see it as an exercise in trying to circumvent ended up in court. Would you agree or not agree with that?
I would not agree.
Okay, we'll have to, I guess, disagree with that, and we'll have to kind of see where this all goes into the future. When it comes to the budget, how do we, and I should remember this, but it's been a few years, how do we allocate the funding for physicians? So a physician is licensed, they have a practice, they bill the province. Is it done quarterly? So I know when the budget's presented, there's an overall estimate of what physician services will cost, and we try to figure out what the upcoming year will be. So how is the money allocated? Is it allocated quarterly, or is the full sum put aside and it's ready to be used?
So my understanding, and if I'm incorrect, I will correct it later. But there is a budget approved for physician services, and physicians provide those services and bill us through our medical services program, and those billings are paid in the normal course.
All right. So money's not allocated from finance on a quarterly basis. Maybe the deputy minister.
Mr. Rayfuse.
As with all department budgets, there's an annual appropriation which goes through this legislative process, and within the Department of Health would be an amount allocated to physician, and it is an annual amount. They would, I would think, allocate it out monthly for internal reporting purposes, but the actual budget is provided on an annual basis.
And it's interesting to know. I mean, we know when we talk about physicians for every Nova Scotian, and the people that don't have physicians, we hear the ratio of per capita, which is somewhat, you can interpret that in many different ways, but I believe we're the second lowest in the country when it comes to funding to physician services. So currently we have in Central Region, I believe, 30 vacancies, 58 across the province from the most recent information that I have as of January. I believe there's 30 in Central, 7 in Eastern, 7 in Northern, 14 in Western. Is there a savings to the province if those positions stay vacant? I know, because I was there, that when a vacant position is in the department, that's a bonus at the end of the year. It gives you wiggle room to spend that money. And we've seen in the last month, my Lord, $70, $80 million of spending from the Premier. So is there a savings from those 58 positions? And that's just primary care. That's just family doctors. I'm not talking about specialists. So is there a savings to the province for those 58 positions the longer they go vacant?
Ms. Parrott?
So I really appreciate you asking that question, because if there's a perception of that out there, I would like to set the record straight that there is absolutely no focus on saving money by not advancing it. In fact, I think what we would find out, and if Mr. Guest has some more information, he can add to it, but there's actually an investment going into the effort to recruit physicians. If anything, we are organizing our resources and putting more effort, I think, that the health authority has put in place recruitment officers in each zone, for example, and those would be new.
So over the last year, are you able to provide the committee the dollar figure around the vacancies that have been there for over the last year, or will I have to wait for the budget estimates to get that number? Can you provide us a figure of what the province has saved by vacancies in the last fiscal year when it comes to family doctors openings here in the province?
So, and I'll ask people to correct me here if I'm wrong, but the physician budget is a volume-driven budget. Is that there is an estimate of what the cost of physician services are in the province. That is part of the requirements of the Canada Health Act, that people access physician services, and those are publicly paid for dollars. So it's a bit of an anomaly compared to some other aspects of the budget where some other budgets have hard caps on them. Generally speaking, physician services is a soft cap because it's driven by the need in the province, and those payments are made because we're committed to public funding for insured physician services. If there is a discrepancy, if there's a delta in a budget between a forecast and an actual, that's just a reflection of the forecast and the prediction of what the volume will be. There is no effort to restrict the hiring of physicians in order to save money on that line.
So I know that the government's moving in the direction that here's these vacancies. Physicians need to sign on to those positions in the central zone, for example. There's 30 since January. Are you able to, how many people applied for those jobs? Like, there's 58 in the province. Can you give us a figure of how many physicians have applied over the last 6 months? To the vacancy positions? Do you have those figures? And if not 6 months, actually in the last year would be very helpful.
So the recruitment is managed by the health authority, so I'm just looking at Mr. Guest if he has those figures. If not, I'll make that inquiry.
Mr. Guest?
I know he was flipping the page, so maybe he found it there.
I can't give you specific numbers as to physicians who have expressed interest in coming to work here in Nova Scotia. I can tell you that since April of 2015, we have hired 71 family physicians and 106 specialists.
So the question, and I think I've asked this before, is how many retired and how many left? Do you have that on that? Why wouldn't you have that right next to how many you hired? I mean, to me, I mean, that makes sense. We need this. We hired this many. I mean, from my understanding, there's another 20 some, almost 30 ready to retire just in central region from the information I have. So you don't keep that side by side? I'm a bit confused on why you wouldn't do that.
So the numbers of physicians that we're actively recruiting would include those as well as vacancies, positions that are open. Okay. It would consider both.
So a position, in these collaborative clinics and the path forward, if a physician is being asked to provide care in a certain region, it goes along with kind of the geography of the area that you live in. Will that doctor be able to bring the patients that they currently have with them if they agree and sign on to one of these vacancy positions? Or will that patient wait list stay wherever that physician was practicing at the time? Or will they be able to bring their current patients with them to a new position if they sign on to one of the vacant ones that are identified?
Ms. Parrott.
So my understanding is they could bring patients with them. We're not at a point in the system, though I read with interest this point in Doctors of Nova Scotia's discussion paper. We're not in a point where we're rostering patients, that we're assigning patients to physicians. So patients have mobility of seeking physician care.
But I know that
province.
I mean, the vacant positions are in areas that residents don't have a doctor. So potentially, then you're saying that there's no restrictions on doctors being able to bring their current patient roster with them. Is that what I'm hearing?
Unless someone corrects me, that is my understanding. I'm not aware of any restrictions in that.
Okay. With the recent paper that I know it's just, I don't know if it was yesterday or today. I got it yesterday. I don't know if that meant it was released yesterday. But is the department going to respond to this? And if so, what's the timeline on the response?
So the department was very happy to receive the paper. We've had discussions with Doctors Nova Scotia saying that, or certainly I have, saying we need to engage on policy discussions. So I think this is a very positive initiative, and we'll absolutely engage and have these discussions. And we appreciate this, just like we do from other professions and frontline workers that have provided input into the system.
So this is quite timely, the paper, I think, and in a lot of, I believe, if I'm not mistaken, I just kind of went through it. There's about 10 recommendations, but many of them, can assist the department and the government in their attempt to ensure that Nova Scotians have access to family doctor and primary care clinicians. So there's a bit of an urgency, I think, especially when you look at some of the recommendations, like we recommend that walk-in clinics be maintained during the transition to a better primary health care system. And there's many more around funding and as you mentioned, making sure that current residents who have doctors continue that if the doctor chooses to move. So you can't give a timeline on a response. Has the minister, I would assume the minister will get this today, and will you ask the minister, how long will we take to respond to the paper that Doctors of Nova Scotia released?
So thank you for the question, and you make an interesting point. I don't see it as a paper that gets an absolute response. I see it as a paper that starts a discussion and hopefully a collaborative discussion as we go forward. I want to say that I think from the department's perspective, we agree with those points made in the document. And I recall the CEO of the Health Authority also indicating that we're not looking at sharp edges as we shift the system into collaborative care. We want the existing system to be stable. And Ms. Knox acknowledged that physicians in solo practices, there'll still be new physicians coming in that replace those physicians when they retire in solo practices, that walk-in clinics do serve a purpose. Absolutely. We're going to encourage linkages to the public and shift the system in a considered, careful way over time.
I would hope I hope that what you said isn't completely accurate, that it starts the discussion. I would hope now that, and I know you're new to the position, but I would hope that the current government has been, engaging with physicians and primary care physicians, family physicians over the last three and a half years. Because I think this part of the paper, I think, is the frustration I think some of the physicians, family physicians, have with the amalgamation of the District Health Authority and their feeling not part of decision making. And the new system and the road forward and the change of model of care will not be successful if it doesn't include those frontline healthcare workers, frontline healthcare physicians. It's the model's there. We've implemented it with the Collaborative Emergency Center model, and unfortunately, I don't see the same thing happening here. When it comes to decision making, it seems like physicians are required to act after decisions are being made. Just quickly, I want to go to the mention of the agreement with the federal government, or whatever it's going to be called once the legislation comes in. Will the terms of that agreement or that legislation, will that be released to the public, the terms that are involved in that, or will we see it in legislation, or is it going to be very vague? Is legislation going to be vague, or will the public get to see what was in the agreement that was signed in December of 2016?
Mr. Rafuse.
Kurt, yes, you will. Actually, in the budget that was tabled by the federal government, there is a provision in there to enable the flow of money. There will be further, I would suspect, regulations that have to be developed at the federal level, and all federal regulations and matters are open to the public, so they will be available when they complete those.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you. We will move to the Liberal Caucus, Mr. Rankin, for 20 minutes.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. This is a good report. This is, in my 3.5 years on the committee, I've never seen the completion rate so high, so I think the department should be commended. But I want to ask my first question to the Deputy Auditor General, because we had the in-camera session, so I don't want to quote anything he had said in that. But what would you attribute the vast improvement in the follow-up recommendations from 2013 and 2014? Is this a good news story?
Mr. Spicer.
Thank you. Yes, overall, it is a good news story. I think the recommendations, we've plotted them in the report, and they are moving in the right direction. To your other point, I think there's a number of reasons you can point to as to why that might be. I think management of the various departments that have done well need to be congratulated for that, and obviously they've put a lot of effort and focus on making those recommendations work. I think, as I mentioned, the Public Accounts Committee and other oversight bodies, oversight and accountability is an important control and tool to helping move these things along. So I think recognition of that effort has to be done as well.
Okay, thank you. And I do think it's important to recognize the management team. A lot of them are here today. So the highest completion rate in 10 years, that's something to be proud of from the department. So now, questioning to the department, I'd like to start with a similar type of question. And what is attributing to the success of improving the processes and procedures and implementing these recommendations, improvement of outcomes? So on a broad level, can we attribute some of that to the amalgamation of district health authorities? So maybe I'll ask the Deputy Minister of Health.
Ms. Parrott.
So thank you for the question. I would say two sides of that coin initially. I think the process of audits is an important process always. And having the recommendations come forward, the process of going through the audit is enlightening. And I think everyone learns from it. I think those are processes you want to embrace and take seriously. And clearly the department did that. I think then going through the amalgamation, you'll see a number of areas in the recommendations that do benefit from having both a consolidation of the health authority so that it operates with a provincial focus. It has that platform. And also a clarity of role between the department and what it's doing and the health authority. So the short answer would be yes. I think that's been part of it.
Okay. Can you point to any tangible improvements when you look at the amalgamation of district health authorities Did the different district health authorities have different policies and procedures? Was there any internal competition when we're talking about whether it's physician recruitment or anything? Does it help improve? Can you point to any of the outcomes that we're seeing now? And I'll dive deeper into the specifics of outcomes, but maybe we'll start with that. And did we learn from other jurisdictions in terms of best practices? I know you came from another province, and I won't ask about that province, but do you sense that Nova Scotia has learned some things, and how do you feel about the implementation of this transformation thus far?
So I'll give a general answer, and then I'll ask Dr. Strang or Mr. Guest to fill it in. Clearly, especially when you're looking at wait times in the organization and developing efficiencies in surgical suites, having a province-wide perspective and being able to coordinate the response to that on a province basis is clearly an advantage. And I think the same would be true with respect to population health surveillance, and the organization of that initiative. So I can ask them to be more specific if you like.
Well, maybe we can just talk about wait time, since you mentioned that in the last 3 years. Are you able to point to any improvement? And the one that MLAs, I think, hear most about, I do certainly, is knees and hips. How is Nova Scotia doing? Have the wait lists improved or not? What are the outcomes?
Ms. Parrott.
Thank you. So in all five priority areas that we focus when we're talking about wait times, Nova Scotia showed improvement on all of them. I think it was the only province that improved on all, because there were some backsliders in the group. And to improve, you have to have a significant process. In areas such as radiation therapy, cataract surgery, and hip fracture repair, the province is really showing good traction there and moving ahead. There is a way to go on hip and knee surgeries, but again, I think the platform and the planning that's going on with the new health authority is setting the stage for that progress to continue.
And you had said, to put in context, that other provinces have not seen improvement in their wait times. I know I saw a report last year where Canada in general, wait times were growing across the board. So we're in the Atlantic region, where we face more challenges with the aging population. I think it's 1,000 people a month now reaching the age of 65. So I just want to make sure I'm hearing that correctly. And I don't know if there's any anything that you can table that actually shows that, notwithstanding our demographic challenges and other jurisdictions around us going up in wait times, that we are actually moving down, and that's the trend. And trends are important. So I just want to make sure that I'm under the understanding that Nova Scotia, wait lists are going down. Other jurisdiction, wait lists are longer.
So not exactly.
Okay.
In Nova Scotia, on all five of the areas where we measure wait times, our wait lists are going down. We were the only province that showed progress on all five. There are other provinces that made progress on some. There are many that are ahead of us still. But all other provinces had a decline in some of their wait lists, is all I was pointing out. So the investment that we've made over the last number of years, the amalgamation of the health authorities and a greater platform for efficiency planning, it looks like that is paying off, and that we are clearly moving in the right direction.
Okay.
There's more to do,
yeah.
And we need to keep at it.
Yeah, obviously there's always more to do. So with the recommendations from the Auditor General, you know, you look at Chapter 6 and there's progress here. Department of Health should obtain a signed letter from all physicians added to academic funding plans. That's done. Department of Health should develop targets for all academic funding plan deliverables. That's done. I can go on and on. There's 12 or 13. They're all complete. There's one that's not. So I think it's part of this committee's job to help normalize when something's not complete. And so the one that's not complete in Chapter 6 is the Department of Health and Wellness should have current signed contracts for all alternative payment plans and academic funding plans. So that's stated as not complete. So again, to help normalize that response, because I think, you know, there should be an opportunity to say where you are at that, what sort of a status update. where are we at for those signed contracts? Maybe you can give some kind of data there, or if there's a percentage of how many contracts are actually complete.
So thank you for the question. In regard to what you're referring to, the signed contracts, I believe it's 593 have signed, 7 have not. So it's largely completed, and I think reasonably to expect that those that have issues with it, we need to understand and address those issues. So there's a bit of a process involved.
So that basically is over 90% of the contracts are done. So that recommendation is over 90% complete, even though in the report it counts as a non-complete.
Correct.
Right. Okay, so let's look at some of the other recommendations. You have Chapter 4. So looking at ones that are incomplete, 4.5, Department of Health and Wellness should implement Recommendation 4.5 from the 2008 report to develop the electronic immunization registry. And I think you referred to some progress in your opening remarks. I could be wrong, but the panoramics, does that relate to that recommendation? So is there any status update for that recommendation?
So the province is proceeding to implement Panorama, which will give us an immunization and vaccine inventory by this fall. And I'll ask Dr. Strang to comment.
Dr. Strang.
Thank you. Yes, so we are in the process now of a two-year project implementing Panorama. One of the components will be a vaccine, managing our inventory of vaccines, as well as developing capacity for public health delivered vaccines to be entered electronically. Moving forward from Panorama, then we need to then do the work as we develop the one patient, one record, linking vaccine records from primary care providers, including doctors and pharmacists. And so ultimately we will have a complete immunization registry. We already are linking in the primary care providers who are on the EMR. We are accessing their data around immunization. So I just want to make sure people understand that Panorama itself doesn't produce a complete immunization registry. It's the first step, and then we link in other sources of immunization data as we move forward on the one patient, one record.
And where are we with the one patient, one record? I think that's a huge benefit to the system for more coordination, and I think it relates to the district health authority being one and sending, you know, electronic messages from family physicians to whatever surgeon or operating room that a patient arrives at. Do we have any sense of timeline when we're going to be able to see that come to fruition?
Ms. Parrott.
So my understanding, so that is moving ahead, and people are quite excited about it. The request for supplier qualifications was issued in January 2017 and attracted a good response. Those responses are being evaluated, so this project is moving ahead. It's hard to comment on it when it's in a controlled supplier environment right now.
Okay. So any of the other recommendations, I guess I'll just ask for a status update. Department of Health and Wellness should develop a plan to implement public health protocols following approval. The plan should include detailed timelines and involve input from stakeholders impacted by the new protocols. Is there any kind of a status update on that?
Dr. Strang?
So the public health protocols are part of our ongoing work between the department and the Nova Scotia Health Authority. They're not a time-limited project, and that's why it's listed as ongoing. There will always be work ensuring that we are the work of public health is guided by what's in the protocols and periodically revisiting those protocols to make sure they're up to date. One of the things we have done during the transition from 9 health authorities to 1, there's a significant amount of work that's been done internally within the Nova Scotia Health Authority Public Health, creating greater consistency across the province in within public health on and one of the key pieces that are using to drive that consistency is the protocol. So moving towards public health practice that is more consistent and more in line with the public health protocols.
Okay, thank you. Maybe you can tell us more of the upcoming clinical services planning framework for surgery, which determines the services that will be offered in each location.
Ms. Parrott.
To Mr. Guest.
Mr. Guest.
Thank you. We're actively working on developing a service plan that meets the needs of the population and looking to make sure that the service offerings that we have in each of our facilities enable that to happen now and into the future.
Okay. And in terms of surgery scheduling, with the District Health Authority amalgamating into one, is that facilitating a broad strategy in terms of the provincial lens, or is that being improved through the amalgamation as well?
Mr. Guest?
Yes, we have recently been able to operationalize an organization-wide program for surgery, and we now have the medical leadership in place, largely, as well as the operational leadership in place to be able to have a structure to revise, create, and review our policy, our protocols, and our program, looking at it from a system perspective and not the 9 entities that we came from. And so that will be a real enabler to help us do that work.
Does that include when a surgeon is working in? I know that there was challenges moving people from district health authorities to another one, and does this amalgamation facilitate an easier move if someone had to go to a surgery in a different zone? Is that more streamlined now?
Yes, our credentialing process within the organization has certainly made that easier. I can give you an example. Last year, we had at the Colchester site in Touro a number of surgeons that our capacity was low there. We weren't maximizing the OR time we had, so we did have 20 days that surgeons from Halifax went to Touro. They did 104 surgeries and over 400 endoscopy procedures during those 20 days.
Okay. Is there any other progress in terms of when, at the hospital level, when a patient, say, I know at one time a doctor had to sign the release to allow a patient to leave. Are we able to say that we're freeing up space for doctors to be somewhere else and have a nurse practitioner, for example? I know that was something that was worked on, and I brought it to the department's attention before. So is that now under implementation?
I would say that's ongoing work, and we certainly do that in a programmatic way that's very intentional. And so I wouldn't say that it's complete. We would be doing that work really on a priority basis as the need for it determines.
Okay. And is there anything else that you can point to in terms of whether it's alternate system delivery or coordinated care that's improving outcomes, but at the same time, you know, being responsible with the financial envelope that we have?
Yeah, I can certainly speak from a surgery perspective. Looking at the service fully as a system certainly has enabled us to maximize more the resources that we have, and I can give you a couple of examples. The Colchester example is one. Another example is maximizing how we use the Hants Community Hospital so that we can do more surgeries in that location to allow the prime operating room capacity in Halifax to be used for higher more complicated surgeries. We're looking at doing that as much as we can. Another example in the Western Zone is that we provide a zone-based service for orthopedics, where orthopedic surgeons from Kentville do procedures in both Bridgewater and Yarmouth to maximize the available resources we have, minimize travel whenever possible, also enable them to use the Kentville OR time for the types of procedures that only that facility is able to do.
Okay, and as that relates to the QE2 VG redevelopment and building infrastructure outside of the peninsula, is there still an appetite to look at facilities outside of the core of the city, and I've brought this up before, but the Halifax West Zone is where the growth is in HRM. Ultimately, something in the same form of Cobequid Center, like an outpatient-type center, which I see as more efficient and better utilization of FTEs within the system. Is there still an appetite to move in that direction?
Certainly with that planning's ongoing. What we are looking philosophically at is doing the work that needs to be in the hospital setting, and where possible, moving care that can be done safely and with high quality into the community setting. Into the community. The Cobequid example you speak of is a really good example of how that successfully can be done, and that is one of the planning parameters in the QE2 redevelopment project. I would also add that one other philosophical approach that we're taking is by maximizing the capacity in some of our regional hospitals in the province. It will allow us to slow the transfer of care to Halifax when it appropriately can be done out in those regional centers, to allow Halifax to focus on quaternary, tertiary care that only they are capable of doing.
And that will, in your view, improve the quality of care?
I think it'll improve the quality of care, it'll improve access, and I think it will help us to have a more stable perioperative program across the province.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you. We'll move back to the PC caucus. Mr. Houston for 13 minutes.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. We've seen the Premier making a lot of announcements over the last 5 or 6 weeks, the last couple of days, a lot around healthcare. And I just wonder, when the Premier makes announcements like he did yesterday around bricks and mortar, is he kind of picking off a list that you've put forward? Have you put forward a list of capital priorities? And are the announcements we're seeing, let's say in the last 2 or 3 days, are they just following your capital priority list? That's for the Deputy.
Ms. Perrette?
Thank you for the question.
Order. Just hold for one moment. We just want to wait until your mic turns on. Ms. Perrette.
Thank you. The capital planning process is an inclusive process that involves the health authority, the department, and communities and community health advisory boards. So the lists that go together, some of them are longstanding lists that projects have been on for a number of years. So I think all of the projects we're seeing going ahead have been identified before.
Yeah. And can you table a list of maybe the top 15 capital projects according to that process? Would you have that a list?
This is not part of capital planning. So I'm just conferring with my colleague. I think that will be part of the information that comes forward when the budget is tabled.
Well, if it's a long-standing process and some of them have been on there for a while, presumably there is a list and has been a list. Can you give me the list from 6 months ago then or something?
Mr. Rafuse.
So just to get clarity, is that process that the Deputy spoke about does feed into the what we refer to as the TCA committee, which makes a recommendation into Treasury Board. That information that comes in there, it is subject to cabinet confidentiality, as we've discussed before, and we have discussed with the Auditor General. So we do have limitations on what is,
okay,
can be provided.
There's a, if I think about schools, there's a known process for schools. We know that this government jumped that process and put schools where they wanted to for political purposes. Is there anything you can tell me that would dispel my concerns that that's what's happening, even if you think about the couple announcements over yesterday? Were yesterday's announcements the top two on the list?
The Deputy indicated those items were on the prioritized list coming up from the department. Some of them are longstanding. Those are the ones that have been chosen to be advanced.
Okay, so we can't see the list. We take it at face value that they're on a list somewhere. Where they're on that list, who knows? It's at the Cabinet's discretion as to where they do the projects. Is that a fair summary?
Yeah, in the democratic process we have, the Cabinet and Treasury Board has the the obligation to, or the right to make those decisions.
Okay.
There's
nothing you can share with this committee, which discusses the finances of the province. There's nothing you can share with this committee that would alleviate my concern that we're just seeing purely political decisions made on the eve of an election. There's nothing you can share with us that would say, well, no, this is the process and can't do it, right?
I can tell you that those announcements have been are accommodated in our fiscal plan and on the capital plan of the province.
Okay. Let's think about one of the announcements yesterday. A fiscal plan implies that there's some costing around it. The premier made an announcement yesterday. He said, I don't know when it's going to, how much it's going to cost or when it's going to get done, but I'm here to announce it today, breezing in on the eve of an election to tell people that he's got some goodies for them. Certainly your fiscal plan probably has things costed, no?
Yeah, the announcement yesterday you're referring to
Pugwash or down in Bridgewater.
As with all major capital projects, there is various stages and various levels of certainty about the costing. The certainty of these projects will not be known until the complete planning is finalized. We do make provisions in the capital plan in the out years, knowing that that commitment has been made. But it's based on the information we have. We tend not to want to release those numbers because they are subject to finalization of community involvement, physician involvement, and the final design of those facilities.
With the issues, the serious issues we have in healthcare in this province, it strikes me as odd that the premier would be running around announcing things that he doesn't know how much they're going to cost or when they're going to happen and not actually focusing on, hey, how about we get some doctors so people can see an actual primary care physician? Does that strike you as odd?
No, actually, that sounds to me to be prudent, to be, not be throwing out numbers at which you can't be validated.
Okay, it's not. I don't see the prudence in announcing things that you can't cost, but whatever. I'd call it political. I wouldn't call it prudent. We'll move on from that. We know political announcements are being made. We know they're not costed. We know they may or may not happen. Maybe someday every Nova Scotian will have a doctor. That was going to happen in 2014. It's now going to happen in maybe 2019, but prudence is not a word I would use for what's happening. We know the federal government is going to take some action around the legalization of marijuana. I'd just like to ask the Deputy of Health a quick question. Have you done any analysis of what the possible costs to the healthcare system might be coming out of the legalization of marijuana over the next 5 or 10 year period? Have you done any kind of costing? Would there be a cost? Common knowledge suggests that there will be some cost to the healthcare system of legalizing marijuana. I guess maybe I'll start with, do you agree with that or not?
Ms. Parrott?
I'm going to refer the question to Dr. Okay. Strang, who's been leading this.
Dr. Strang?
So no, there hasn't been any costing done because we don't know the regulatory framework under which cannabis will be legalized. There's a lot of detail which needs to be come from the federal government. There are significant decisions which have to be made here provincially. But I think just we need to understand that there is no lack of access and therefore use of cannabis today. And our objectives that have been approved by Cabinet under legalizing cannabis will be to protect, first and foremost, protect the health and the safety of the Nova Scotia public, as well as to decrease the input of or the footprint of organized crime. So depending on what, if we adhere to those objectives, we will actually get decreased use and overuse of cannabis and therefore presumably decreased health and criminal justice and other costs. It all depends on what decisions are made around how we regulate this.
Okay, so is that your succinct, if I just tried to, in the interest of time, boil it down, you'd say legalization of marijuana will result in less use and less overuse of marijuana?
Depends on how it's legalized. Depends on what framework, and how it's sold and
presumably where it's sold and age would be the two, would they be the two influencers of how you, where you, of your kind of guess on what happens?
Where it's sold, what age, how we allow, do we allow marketing, a whole range of decisions that have to be made both federally and provincially. And we look at other substances like tobacco and alcohol and other things.
Do you have any thoughts on the age? I heard 18 is what the feds are going to go with. Do you have any opinion on
if that's too high, too low.
The discussion we've had and the direction from Cabinet has been that Nova Scotia should stick with a minimum age of 19, and if there's opportunities to move higher than that in collaboration with other provinces to do so.
Okay. Okay. Question, thank you for that. Question, what's the average length of time that a physician vacancy remains vacant in Nova Scotia? Do we have an average length of time for, does it take a year to fill them or 6 months to fill them? Or do we have an average length of time?
Dr. Perrette, or Ms. Perrette?
Thank you for the promotion. I'm going to look to Mr. Guest if he can fill this in. But the point I want to make at the outset is the process of enrolling, having a list of patients looking for a doctor. So remember, we've been...
just in the interest of time, the question is how long does the position stay vacant?
Well, part of the answer is that this is not a new issue. It's a long-standing issue.
So there should be more evidence as to how long.
And starting in this province last year is the first time we've put together a list and the first time that it's been tracked. So it's still relatively early days of starting a process that's very intentional about tracking the need and starting to link need to community demand. So I'm not aware that there is, in this short period of time, an average period that's been tracked, but I'll let Mr. Guest correct me if I'm wrong.
Mr. Guest?
That would be correct. At this point, I'm not able to respond to that.
Too early to say. Okay, fair enough. Too early to say. So I do want to ask a question about payments to specialists in this province. Is there something happening where the health authority or the department is withholding back a certain amount of monies due to specialists? 10% are you aware of that happening? That specialist remuneration is being held back by 10%?
Ms. Parrott?
Sorry, I'm going to refer it to Dave.
Mr. Bartol?
The AFP contract provides for a holdback of 10% that's managed within the departments.
Okay, so is that new or old? Or?
That's new in this current agreement.
Okay, so in this new agreement, there's a holdback of 10% on monies that are due for services that were rendered, right? The services would have been rendered, but they're holding back 10%.
It's a holdback within the AFP departments pending confirmation of fulfillment of deliverables, yes. And so it's managed within the departments, yes.
Do you have a sense as to whether specialists are happy with that or not happy with that?
All I can say is that the AFP contract was ratified to 87% favorability by the AFP physicians. We haven't heard any statements of unhappiness around those practices.
Okay, fair enough. I do want to talk, I just want to try and understand the targeted funding from the federal government. It was kind of advertised over the Christmas holidays as, I think, $287 million, which was $150 for home care and $130-some-odd for mental health. Are you familiar with the number, Deputy Rafe? $287 million. Is that over 10 years? I know you don't want to get into the specific annual amounts, but that's the number that was published.
Mr. Rafuse?
Yeah, those would have been 10-year amounts that we were...
Over 10 years, okay. So I know you can't say how much of that is going to happen this year and next year and stuff until the budget comes, I guess. But is there any science behind that? Is there a plan for, well, gee, if we had $150 million for home care, we could do this or we could do that? Or was it just a number went down on a piece of paper and the minister said, sure? Is there a plan for that?
The plan to use that money would be within the Department of Health. This is an allocation based on a federal transfer and the dollars attached to it. How that money is used and the reporting back to that, that's a separate initiative.
Only have a minute, Deputy. Does the Department of Health have a plan that to use how those monies will be used, and can they share that plan with us?
Ms. Parrott?
Thank you. Our understanding from the federal government is that they want to put in place an accountability framework that will have specific I'll use the word eligible, though I don't know if that's entirely the correct word, types of activities that will be eligible for the funding.
So we don't even know. So
we haven't.
So they want to know how you spent it. I'm wondering how you're planning to spend it, and you're saying we don't know how we're going to spend it until they say how we can spend it.
They need to give us the parameters of what projects or types of projects that they consider eligible for that type of funding.
They haven't done that.
They haven't done it yet, no.
It's been 5 months. Is that not uncommon or...
Order. Time has expired. We'll move to the NDP caucus. Mr. Wilson, you have 13 minutes.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. In the Auditor General's report for the Chapter 1 of the follow-up for recommendations from 2013 and 14, it indicated concerns remained with some organizations, and one was with the Nova Scotia Health Authority, that it has not established targets, leaving Nova Scotians unsure when surgery wait times will improve. And I know in 2013, Stephen McNeil, our current Premier, promised to reduce wait times and that he would put in $8.1 million to operating rooms to ensure that the province meets the 6 months standard for hip and knee replacement. We know now, I think hip is around 17 months and knees are around 20. Just wondering if that $8.1 million was invested in the operating rooms over the mandate of the current government.
Ms. Parrott?
So again, I'll ask Mr. Guest to go into more specifics, but yes, I believe that the investment that's been made to reduce wait times, the value of that investment is being seen in the reduction of wait times and progress is being made. But Mr.
Guest,
you might elaborate.
Thank you. The access to the additional money did have an impact in our volumes. We in 2015, 2016, were able to do 614 procedures for individuals who were waiting longer than a year. In this current fiscal year ending in March, we increased that to 855. This would be the first year we've been able to spend a full allotment that we were given out of the $8.1 million. We did request additional money from the department and were given access to do that, which did enable us to get to that 855.
So there has been a reduction, but part of the commitment from the Premier was to meet the 6 months wait time targets. And, you know, the Auditor General saying that the department or health authority won't even establish if they agree or don't agree with making those targets. So is it that the health authority is pushing back on the commitment from the Premier, or is it that the Premier really probably should have never made that commitment to Nova Scotians, because it's not reality with the funding formula that Treasury and that the current government's giving towards trying to meet that 6 months target that that provinces are trying to reach. So are you concerned that you haven't fulfilled the Premier's promise, or is that something that I think the Premier probably should have not made that promise to Nova Scotians?
Mr. Guest.
Thank you. I can't comment on the Premier's comment. I've not heard them. What I can say is that we are in the process of putting in place targets. We intend to be fully compliant with the Auditor General's recommendations by the fall of this year. We have said all along that this is going to be a lengthy process to meet the national benchmark. We have a ways to go. We're headed in the right direction, which is a big change from 2 years ago when we continued to get worse year over year. I think it's going to take some a change in how we do business in order to meet the target, but it is our goal to get there. We believe it is the right thing for Nova Scotians to do, but it's not going to be an easy road.
I appreciate that, and I think that's definitely misguided on the Premier's side to try to state that. Of course, the other area, of course, is the commitment for a doctor for every Nova Scotian that the Premier indicated prior to becoming Premier of this province. And I know that his commitment was to open up medical spots. I believe it was 25 a year. So in year four, there'd be 100 potentially. as we move forward. Of course, they don't start practicing right away. They got to finish their schooling. So has that commitment been kept, and are we going to see a benefit from an additional 100 spots? Is the Premier at a position that he can check that box off as he goes and asks for another mandate for Nova Scotians, from Nova Scotians?
Ms. Perrette?
So the answer to that question is something that I have to follow up on.
So you're not sure if the 25 spots per year were added to Dalhousie. So I'll take you on that, and hopefully we'll find out sooner than later. In August of 2015, the Premier said that he was opposed to the federal government providing health funding to the provinces based on population without taking the aging demographics into account. And we know that Nova Scotians' aging demographic is we have one of the oldest populations. So did the government ask the federal government to change the funding formula to take into account Nova Scotians' aging population?
I think my colleague will take that.
Mr. Rafuse?
Certainly, it's quite well known that our strict per capita funding formula does come to the detriment of provinces like ourselves who have an aging demographic. Unfortunately, you can't get agreement across the country where other provinces are quite adamant where a strict per capita is the way to go. Therefore, it would be to our benefit because it does reflect our reality. But you could not get agreement. There are some provinces that are adamant not to shift off this.
And I understand that, but we didn't negotiate a health agreement with the other provinces. We did it on our own. So did the province ask the federal government to take into account the aging population of a province? I mean, getting agreement from across the province doesn't matter because we didn't work with them to get our agreement in the first place. So was there a request from the team of negotiators that Nova Scotia would like to see our aging population factor into the formula for health transfers?
That was a request for the change, but that is a national agreement. The CHST is a national agreement.
Right, I know the federal minister was very vocal, publicly indicated that when she goes to the finance minister to ask for more money, she needs to be able to tell that her minister that the money will be used for health care. So over the last 2.5 years, I know under the current government, there has been an underspending of health budgets, $22 million, I believe, last year or 2 years ago, and then $23 million. So about $45 million underspent in 2 years. And then, of course, we know also around the health infrastructure budget that was severely underspent. I believe through the mandate of the government, there was about $140, $150 million in the budget for that, and I think $70, $75 million was spent. So does that weaken our position when we were negotiating with the federal government to say we need more money in Nova Scotia, not only to meet our aging population, the demographics, but the federal minister is saying that we need to show that money is going to health care, yet here in Nova Scotia we've underspent significantly, I would say, in a number of areas, the budget. So would that weaken our position in trying to ask for more funding for Nova Scotians when we were negotiating with the federal government?
That never entered in the conversation with the federal government. Be well aware that we based our projections based on actual spending, not for actuals versus budget. The trends that were developed in response or to develop a position between all provinces looked at national trends as well as provincial trends. So no, it did not factor into the conversation.
Hence why maybe we may have jumped the gun on negotiating with the province. And I know my colleague, and I would agree with my colleague when he said, I think we put the rest of the provinces at a disadvantage, jumping so quickly a couple days before Christmas. So when I talked about the infrastructure budget, for example, hospital infrastructure budgets were significantly underspent. Across 3 years of budgets, there was $146 million, but only $72 million was spent. And we just heard yesterday from the Premier that a replacement for the Pugwash Hospital is a commitment from the government, and I think I heard construction in 2018. Why would we underspend the budget for 3 years and then on an eve of an election commit to people in Pugwash we're going to replace their hospital? Or, you know, are Nova Scotia supposed to just take the premier at his word that most likely there's an election between now and construction of the Pugwash Hospital? Are Nova Scotia just supposed to take the premier at his word and roll the dice and hopefully they'll commit to this? Because there's a number of examples that, you know, the premier has said many things prior to getting elected. You know, doctors for every Nova Scotian. You know, film tax credit would be supported and maintained. ER closures, we'd continue to make sure that there was a reduction in ER closures, and I think I could go on and on. But why would we underspend the infrastructure budget for 3 years, but yet today or yesterday the premier is announcing a replacement of a new hospital and actually telling a construction time? Is that, do you see concerns there, and maybe that it is really just about a pending election and not really the needs of communities in the province? I don't know if the deputy minister of health would like to answer that.
I have a perspective.
So I think my colleague,
Ms. Parrott.
Sorry, I think my colleague would like to answer the question. I haven't been part of the capital planning process for a number of years, so he can probably provide a better perspective.
Mr. Rafuse.
You are true. The underspend in the health capital has happened all the couple of years. The understanding we have is when the department reports into us is that as a system is going through a major administrative reorganization and as a go forward on their health services planning, you do need to pause on things to make sure that you're doing the right things. And that was the reason why the underspends occurred.
So I know in the announcement, the Premier indicated construction in 2018, but yet we know that the Centennial Building has been at the forefront for a number of years now for need of a replacement. But yet there's no timeline on when we will see construction happening with the transition of services out of the Centennial Building. What can you give us an update on when those services and when will we see bricks and mortar for the replacement of the Centennial Building at the VG site?
Ms. Parrott?
So I don't have a timeline for you, but I can tell you that the planning for the QE2 project is very intense and is going ahead at speed.
Thank you, Mr. Wilson. You have about 30 seconds.
Well, it's interesting that the Premier can tell us construction timeline on one project, yet not give us the budget for it, but yet a project that's been in the works for years now, we still don't know where those services are going to go or where we may see a new facility being opened up. Obviously, it's evident. The evidence has shown that the Premier and the current government have not put in place priority on health care here in Nova Scotia.
Order. And time has expired. We'll move to the Liberal caucus. And Mr. Stroink.
Thank you very much for coming again today. I guess I want to kind of have a discussion on the transfers that come from Ottawa and how do we derive to those numbers, and also a little bit of a historic piece to this too, because under the PC federal government there was a significant unilateral decision on health transfer costs, and so that Nova Scotia can understand where we are today, can you explain what happened and how we got to the number that we're at kind of now? That would be a great kind of segue into the questions that I kind of have for you today.
Mr. Rafuse.
Thank you. I'm going to start, and then maybe I'll ask Leilani to fill in a bit here. But certainly there was, under the previous government, there was a change in way in which the formula was. There was a built-in escalator of 6%. That government chose to unilaterally change it away from that and into a strict per capita spending. And those agreements or those were enshrined in legislation until 2024. I can give you some historical pattern, but I'm going to ask Leilani to fill in what I've missed, or maybe fill in that in a bit better than that. Sorry.
Thank you.
Ms. Kumaraniaki.
So as we discussed, the current agreement is a 10-year agreement that lasts till 2324. So there was no impetus for the federal government to negotiate this at its current time, apart from looking at the priorities and the needs. One thing that was really significant is in 17-18, the 6% escalator. So the way the CHT transfer works is there is a pool of money, and it is allocated across the provinces purely on a per capita formula that was brought in by the Harper government. The second change, which was going to commence this year, 17-18, is that that escalator will be reduced to a three-year moving average with a minimum of 3%. This year it will kick in at 3%. So were there no changes, all the provinces would be the growth in our transfers would reduce, and we estimated that would be over $20 million for Nova Scotia. With this new Liberal government in Ottawa, there was an ability to be able to discuss and look at what are some of the priorities and say our current growth in health care transfers is going down because of the previous government's changes in the escalator. However, we do have needs, and this is how the discussions around more targeted funding have arisen. And it's anticipated that the federal government will be spending about $11 billion in addition to the CHT transfer.
So it was more with the Liberal government, it was the feds, it was more of a bit of a negotiation on how the provinces can utilize those money. So what, in those two aspects, what did Nova Scotia get in those negotiations with the Liberal feds?
So we will still continue to have our base transfer, the CHT transfer. The benefit for provinces of that base transfer, so that's $967 million for next year, is that's an unconditional transfer. So that's used as part of our $4.3 billion budget, but it's used according to the priorities that we have. In addition, there is this targeted funding, particularly for mental health, et cetera, and those envelopes are currently being negotiated. Deputy Perrette spoke about the discussions are ongoing as to what those are eligible programs are, and we anticipate there will be a federally legislation for this targeted funding coming in through this budget implementation process.
Thank you very much. And I guess that's kind of all I have now for the transfers. I might come back to you on another question, but I guess my question now is for the Deputy Minister of Health. The question that people need to understand is, I hear it a lot, is the wait times for hips and knees are an issue in Nova Scotia, but there's a historical factor that people aren't understanding. How did we get to where we are today? Like, how did we get this massive backlog with hips and knees?
Ms. Perrette?
So I think there's a combination of factors that you would see across the country, because the reason you have this focus on five waitlist factors is it wasn't an issue just for Nova Scotia, it was an issue across the country. And part of that is the complexity of running the hospital systems, the increased demand, I think over, and I'm not sure what the timeline is, the increased demand for hips and knee surgeries across the country, it was quite a dramatic incline. And so the system has been responding to increased demand, and the need to become more efficient. So you see initiatives like Nova Scotia's undergone with a consolidated health authority to create that platform for more efficiency in different provinces as well. But a number of factors in play.
So on the list right now, we had such a massive backlog of patients to have the surgeries. Where are we now compared to where we were 4 years ago?
So I'm going to refer it to Mr. Guest, because I know there was an emphasis on what they called the long waiters to deal with that first.
Mr. Guest.
Thank you for the question. Since 2012, our volumes of procedures that we've done for hips have increased by 7%. Our volumes of knees have increased by 10%. Those are the numbers that we were performing. There has been a subsequent increase in demand on the hip side
On the knee side, in that time frame, it's gone down by 1%, and so it's enabled us to start to catch up there. We have had a higher focus on knees during this time frame because our wait list for individuals waiting for knees is considerably longer than hips, and they're waiting a considerably longer period of time. And so I would say that we are starting to be able to see a dent in the wait list, but it's going to take a considered effort for us to be able to tackle that backlog. This year and the previous year was the first year we've actually not seen the list grow, which has been a considerable change in what was happening before. I can add a comment to your previous comment about how we got here.
Yeah.
In the previous, prior to the establishment of the Nova Scotia Health Authority, the previous nine districts all had different sets of priorities of which they prioritized their resources. They weren't all aligned. We also had challenges with health human resources. We've had issues with anesthesia coverage over the last 5-10 years that ebbs and flows. We've had nursing shortages in some areas of the province, in the ORs particularly. A couple of the previous district health authorities prior to the establishment of the long waiter strategy had caps on their surgeries because of funding. And so there's a multitude of reasons why the backlog has grown. Moving to one district health authority with one set of priorities, one set of processes, and dealing with all of those issues the same certainly is an enabler for us to be able to do a better job of dealing with that issue.
So what I just heard is what this government has done by changing it to one health authority has significantly helped the processes within the health authority in hips and knee surgeries, as an example. Is that a fair statement to say?
I would say that it's given us the opportunity to have a consistent approach with how we allot resources so that we are all steering the boat in the same direction with the same goal. That's, I think, the biggest contribution to what it's enabled us to do.
So also, I guess, on that long waiters list, are there people on that list that are on the list who've been there for a very, very long time, but are on that list for health reasons? And until their significant health changes or their health issues changes, then they'll be able to have their surgery. Is that some of that happening on that list?
According to policy, in order to be on the list, you have to be eligible and ready to have your surgery at any given time. There are periods when an individual goes on the list that their health status changes. And according to our the government policy related to being on the wait list, the timeline should cease and it starts to count again once they're considered medically eligible to have their surgery. We're doing a significant amount of work making sure that the list is accurate, and we've done a lot of cleanup. I can say that since 2012, we have decreased the longest waiting individual on the wait list by 29%.
Excellent. Thank you very much. Back to Mr. Rafies. Mr. Rafies, what in the upcoming budget, there was an initiative on the small business tax that's occurring. Can you just explain to what that initiative is?
Mr. Rafies.
Yes, the Minister of Finance announced that in the upcoming budget, the threshold for small business, where the business is eligible for the small business tax rate, will be raised from the current level of $350,000 to $500,000. So those businesses that meet certain criteria, that income level now will reduce from the general rate to the small business rate.
And then also the small business tax would be decreased by?
No, the small business rate will stay the same.
Okay. So what I'm trying to get at here is, are most doctors self-employed?
I think all doctors are self-employed, but a lot of them are incorporated professionals, if that's what you're asking.
Yeah. Yes. So, what I'm trying to get at is, this new tool, is this a great new tool to recruit doctors into Nova Scotia? Does this help with that process?
Yes, it is a tool. If the doctor chooses to incorporate themselves, this would be made available to them as well.
Excellent. Thank you. And now I'm going back to something that was said earlier about doctors in Nova Scotia and the shortage. We are, and I know we've had this conversation last week, and I need to say it again because there's been some misinformation again. Where are we in Canada with all our other jurisdictions in the recruitment process of a plan? Like, you came here specifically to Nova Scotia for a reason, Deputy Minister Health. Can you share that again so that people who might have missed it last week can hear it again this week?
Ms. Parrott?
You're correct. Nova Scotia is a very attractive place to come if you're interested in healthcare reform, partly because there's an innovative, collaborative spirit here. There's good discussions, and we're seeing that, right? We have healthcare workers, frontline workers, professional groups contributing to that discussion. And the platform, the size, the progress made in this province really positions it well to move ahead. I think it is among the leaders in Canada for the type of shifts that need to be made in the system. An example is the proactive nature of physician recruitment. I think it is highly organized here, and I can't say for sure that no one else is at the same point, but I would, I know that we are leading, among the leaders, I should say.
Can you also just give us a quick timeline for the QE2 for the infrastructure projects that are occurring there?
Thank you for the question, because I wasn't able to answer Mr. Wilson when he asked. There is a timeline for the QET on a website. So I'm happy to say that if you go to connectedcare.ca, you can watch the planning process from that perspective. Thank you.
Order. Thank you very much for everyone's questions and, of course, for all the answers from our witnesses. Mr. Rayfuse.
Yes, earlier somebody asked for a copy of my opening remarks. I'd like to table a copy and have a copy for all the committee members as well.
Thank you very much, Mr. Rayfuse. We do have some time left, and I will allow both departments to provide some brief closing comments. Perhaps you can keep it to about 2 minutes if you can. Ms. Parrott.
Thank you very much. And I'll just respond to a question that I didn't answer earlier with respect to the capital plan. I'm advised that we provided the committee with a list of projects that are on the capital plan last November, December. South Shore and Pugwash were both on that list, so there would be some information provided to the committee. And then I thank the committee for this opportunity to have the discussion. I actually learned something from these discussions, and I've now come to describe it as an unusual onboarding process, but one that I actually do appreciate, and thank you for the discussion.
Thank you, Ms. Parrott. Mr. Rayfuse.
Yes, to the committee, thank you very much for having me here. And if you want to invite me back sometime to talk about internal controls over financial reporting, which we never got to that topic, we're certainly welcome to do that.
Okay. Thank you very much. Our next meeting is on April 19th, and that is to discuss regulatory review, and we will have the Office of Regulatory Affairs and Service Effectiveness with us. Prior to that meeting, we have a subcommittee meeting to select topics for future meetings, and that begins at 8:30 on April 19th. On April 26th, we do not have a meeting, but on May 3rd, we have a meeting on school capital planning, and that's on Chapter 2 of the November 2016 report of the Auditor General. The Auditor General has offered a briefing prior to that meeting. We have a couple of options. As I mentioned, our next meeting begins at 8:30 would conclude at 11 o'clock. Usually we do our briefings before the meetings, but that's not to say we couldn't add a briefing in on the 19th for the May 3rd meeting. The other option is to have the briefing on May 3rd, perhaps at 8:30, a half hour before the meeting starts. Do members have a preference? I did see a couple of heads nod in favor of 8:30 a.m. on May 3rd. All those in agreement? I see agreement. Our clerk will make note of that. Is there any further business to come before the committee? Hearing none, this meeting is adjourned.